I was watching that Sylvester Stallone remake of Get Carter the other day, and aside from marvelling that 23 years have passed since its release, I was once again wondering about the logic of producing such films. This version of Get Carter, like many modern-ish remakes, falls into the category of being an okay film, if you can see past the fact that it's meant to be a remake of an iconic and much better film and judge it on its own merits instead. The trouble is this is difficult to do, as not only does it have the same title, same character names and basic plot, but even uses the distinctive theme tune from the original. Technically, of course, it could be claimed simply to be a new interpretation of the source material, the novel Jack's Return Home by Ted Lewis, given a contemporary US setting, but the aforementioned factors, particularly the use of the original film's title rather than the book's title, mitigate against it. The same problem afflicts other remakes which present themselves as a reinterpretation of the source material, yet try to retain elements of the previous adaptation. The second Total Recall, which, like Get Carter, is a decent enough film in its own right, but is weighed down by recycling that title. The source story was Philip K. Dick's We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, and Vera's characters and the film recycle, yet the film, the remake, chooses to use the original's title and indeed recycles various characters from the predecessor. Soon as you do that, you invite comparisons, which, if the film you are remaking, like the 1971 Get Carter, is considered a definitive example of its genre. Obviously, I understand the commercial logic of these sorts of remakes to trade on the name and reputation of the original. It's the same logic that drives the production of identikit sequels to box office hits. Audiences like the familiar, the logic goes. The further the new film, be it a remake or sequel, varies from the original, the greater the danger that audiences will be alienated, which is doubtless why the Get Carter remake replicates not just stretches of dialogue, but also entire sequences from the original. The opening train journey montage, for instance, which is not from the book, but purely a creation of Mike Hodges' original film. Unfortunately, what it can't replicate is the essence of the 1971 version, replacing its working-class gangster grittiness with a glossy look, softening the violence, and giving its lead character a redemptive arc instead of the nihilistic inevitability of the original's ending. But at least it's still recognisably Get Carter, in contrast with the other remake of a classic British crime caper starring Michael Caine, The Italian Job, which simply retains the title. The idea of using minis in a heist in Italy and a character called Bridger. In its defence, it could at least be argued that it is a proper reimagining of the original's concept rather than an attempt to replicate it in a different setting. Which brings us to the question of exactly what is the purpose of a remake in the first place? Back in the day, their selling point was that they added something the original couldn't offer. In the 30s, that meant sound. In the 40s and 50s, it meant colour. After that, the added value might be widescreen 3D, or perhaps an ability to take advantage of changes in censorship regulations or moral standards, meaning that the new version could be more forthright, perhaps in terms of language, perhaps in terms of nudity, sex, and/or violence. Or it might just be that the original didn't represent a satisfactory treatment of the source material. Although sadly, this no longer seems to be a consideration. His studios seem to focus their energy on remaking good films these days, presumably because they hope they can replicate the success of the original. The trouble is that when films made from the 70s onwards are remade, there really isn't much that can be added in terms of new value or innovation. Remakes of things like Night of the Living Dead or Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for instance, have to try and trade on the fact that makeup effects have improved since the originals were made, so that the new films are gorier and more realistic. Yet they're never as satisfying as the originals, which not only had a spark of originality about them, but also ingenuity in the way in which they made them so effective despite the makers not having access to those new special effects technologies that the remakes did. The alternative, is simply to remake the concept behind the original so that you end up with the in-name-only remake, like Roger Vadim's US remake of his own and God-created Woman. Which leaves you wondering what the point of obtaining the rights to the original were, aside from being able to trade on an already familiar title and preventing anybody else from spoiling your version by putting out their own remake. But we live in an age when just about every major studio release seems to be a remake or a sequel, the result of a dearth of originality and a lack of commercial confidence in a new idea, in new ideas. So I fear that we're eventually going to see just about every film, good, bad or mediocre, that ever turned a buck at the box office, remade in one way or another. So brace yourselves. Actually, as a footnote, I should add that Get Carter actually had an earlier remake as the 1972 blaxploitation film Hitman. Like the Stallone film, this relocates the action to the US, but retains most of the plot and characters, suitably adapted for the new milieu. Unlike the Stallone film, it does succeed in creating a distinct identity of its own, establishing a style and tone somehow suited to the new setting. The change of title also helps it feel as if it is a reinterpretation of the source material with a distinct identity of its own rather than a straight remake.
Lena!
Thank you. How was your trip?
I am Count Dracula. Wait.
Father, you know what is happening.
In the name of God, I command you, go back!
It gives them extreme power.
You were wrong to turn against me.
In the late 70s, in the wake of Profondo Rosso, 1975 or 1977 Suspiria, it had been announced that Dario Argento was to direct a version of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Then expectations would have been sky high. The idea of the director bringing the visual sense, deft use of acoustic effects and sheer style he had demonstrated in his giallo movies to the gothic classic would have been something to look forward to. Unfortunately, though, Argento didn't make his Dracula until 2012, when his best films seemed long, long behind him, with the result being a major disappointment. To be honest, the last Argento film I really enjoyed was 1987's Opera. Well, in my opinion, an improvement on its predecessor, the 1985 movie Phenomena, also known as Creepers. It still fell well below the high standards he had set himself in his earlier films. But in comparison to 2012's Dracula 3D, it looks a masterpiece. The film's problems are numerous, but start with a fundamentally flawed script, which fails completely to offer any new angles on the oft-told tale. Indeed, it seems to be a compendium of ideas ransacked from other Dracula movies and lumped together with little consideration of coherence, characterization, or plot development. Large parts of the scenario, Harker being a librarian rather than an estate agent, and the decision to set the whole story in Transylvania, thereby relocating key London scenes to a village near the castle, comes from Hammer's 1958 Dracula, with Van Helsing casting of the Silver Bullet coming from the company's later Satanic Rites of Dracula, which was made in 1973. While the identification of the Count with the historical Vlad Tepes Dracula not to mention Mina being the reincarnation of his lost love, is taken from the Coppola Dracula, which in turn had lifted the idea from Dan Curtis's 1974 TV movie version of Dracula, which had starred Jack Palance. And that's just a few examples of its borrowings. The problem with this approach is that it means that the various significant characters and events central to the source novel vanish. Lucy Suitors and the arrival in Whitby of the ghost ship carrying Dracula to England, for instance. And worse, by wrenching these borrowings out of their original context, the whole story becomes dislocated. In the Hammer Dracula, the librarian Harker is actually an associate of Van Helsing at Castle Dracula to try and kill the Count, which after his demise neatly brings the vampire hunter into the story. In this version, however, with Harker simply being a librarian and there being no Dr. Seward and no asylum to justify his presence, Van Helsing simply wanders into the latter stage of the story. His presence is explained by a clumsy flashback to Carfax Asylum in England and an earlier encounter with Dracula, implying the events of the novel have all occurred off-screen in the film's past. It makes little sense and never really justifies Van Helsing's rather arbitrary presence in the film. Worse still, without a local asylum, the character of Renfield is left high and dry, presented as some kind of random local nutter. Stripping the story down to its bare essentials can pay dividends to filmmakers, as shown by Hammer's fast-moving and highly efficient 1958 production. But unfortunately, Dracula 3D's script feels the need to provide substitutes for the missing characters and events, none of them very good, nor particularly interesting. The whole subplot about the village's leading figures colluding with a count for a quiet life ultimately goes nowhere and isn't developed enough to provide any kind of commentary upon the nature of feudalism. Well, characters like the policeman, the innkeeper and the sinister trader are barely sketched in. But even with a weak script, prime Argento would surely have been able to make something out of the material. But it isn't prime Argento at the helm. There's none of the visual sense and lush style of his best giallo movies here, and consequently no atmosphere, no suspense or feeling of menace. Far too much of the film seems to take place in bright sunlight, on the streets of an underpopulated and far too clean and wholesome looking village. The sets are unimpressive and, in many scenes, cheap looking. The whole thing comes over as flat and uninvolving, like a TV movie. This impression is reinforced by the dreadful CGI used in too many scenes, with the practical special effects being no more convincing. On top of all this, Argento fails to get interesting performances from most of his cast, in particular, Thomas Kretschmann, usually a very reliable actor, is badly miscast as the most underwhelming Dracula ever to see the screen. He fails to exude any menace, let alone the imperiousness and sense of ancient evil the role requires. Marta Gastini and Unax Ulgarde, as Mina and Jonathan Harker respectively, likewise fail to breathe any life into their underwritten characters, while Asia Argento's Lucy is largely uninteresting, whether alive or undead. Only Rutger Hauer, as Van Helsing, comes close to giving the sort of performance required for this sort of film. Well, as Van Helsing is neither as crazy and eccentric as Anthony Hopkins' interpretation in the Coppola film, nor as steely and obsessive as Peter Cushing's in the Hammer films, he is at least memorable and the only character in the film who seems to know what they're doing. And incidentally, it's the only time a Dutch actor has actually played Van Helsing on screen, and Van Helsing, of course, being Dutch. Now, obviously, I've never seen Dracula 3D in 3D, so I might have been missing something. Perhaps when shown stereoscopically, it doesn't feel as flat or look as cheap. But I can only judge it by the 2D version I was recently able to stream, which, to be absolutely fair, seemed to be a TV edit, cutting out some gore and nudity. On that basis, it's a major disappointment, particularly for fans of the director, like myself. It just doesn't feel like an Argento film, capturing neither the somewhat stylized and lush look of his 70s films, which it would have benefited from, nor the somewhat harder-edged, more realistic look of his 80s and 90s output. Even frequent collaborator and Goblin keyboardist Claudio Simonetti's score fails to lift the film, sounding bland, derivative and detached from the on-screen action. It just plays in the background, adding nothing to any scene. Worst of all is the lack of originality in the film's execution. It's a film of borrowings, none of them apparently properly understood, resulting in a treatment that feels tired and hackneyed. It speaks volumes that Argento wouldn't direct another film for 10 years after this debacle.
Shift into gear for the comedy of the year and see the little beetle who slugs it to the thugs. Dudu the superbug, and he's going on extra tour. Take a backseat ride in this crazy bug for some wild front seat action. In the air, on the slopes, and on the highways. With high powered force, you'll be right on course as Dudu and his partner Jimmy Bondi give the bad guys a hard time as the unbeatable duo that is stamping out crime in the wildest, wackiest, rampaging riot on or off the road. Superbug on extra tour, whatever you do, don't miss it.
The Superbug or Dudu series of films is something I've long been aware of, but until recently I'd never seen any of the 5 films in the series. Now, if you didn't know, these films are most often described as the German answer to Walt Disney's Herbie films, like them featuring a VW Beetle car capable of performing amazing feats. While Herbie seemed to be possessed of some kind of living spirit, Dudu, which we're told in the English dub of the first film, which is set in Africa, is Swahili for bug or insect, is technologically enhanced by his owner to the point in some films that it seems to have its own AI. The films were produced in West Germany between 1971 and 1978, all directed by and starring Rudolf Zietberger, billed as Robert Mark in the English language versions of some films. Aimed primarily at children, the films were cheaply made but popular. The film I caught the other week was the last of the series and not, as it turned out, a good starting point. Made 3 years after the previous entry, Son of Superbug, aka The Return of Superbug, feels like an afterthought to the main series. Indeed, arguably, isn't really a Dudu film at all. The eponymous VW is wrecked during the first 5 minutes or so, which must have been pretty traumatic for kids who'd seen the previous films. Rather than repair or rebuild Dudu, the hero instead spends the rest of the film driving around in a 6-wheel all-terrain vehicle. He's also accompanied by an irritating talking robot crab thing called Picho, which acts as a sort of Dudu substitute. Actually, the switch to the 6-wheeler is rather confusingly presented, in the English language version at least, after Dudu is shoved down a steep slope, breaking apart in the process. We quickly cut between a shot of its body shell sliding away on its roof, and its owner, referred to in this film as El Groncho, rather than Jimmy Bond, as he is in other films. We see him tipping the 6-wheeler, which is on its side upright. The implication seems to be that the all-terrain vehicle was originally incorporated into Dudu. Perhaps the original edit made this clearer. So in spirit, one could argue that Dudu lives on for the rest of the film, except that his technological functions are now embodied in Pichu rather than the 6-wheeler. In fact, the original German title translates as Two Awesome Beetles Clean Up, with Dudu and his successor 6-wheeler, by implication, the two Beatles. Thereafter, the film settles down into a treasure hunt of sorts, as various parties seek out a hoard of stolen mafia gold which has been hidden on Lanzarote. These include the usual stereotypical mafia don and his henchmen, the retired German army officer who masterminded the heist, and a local shady millionaire who's also trying to dispose of his young nephew in order to get full control of the fortune he is heir to. El Groncho, using Picho and various other gadgets, inevitably outwits them all and saves the boy. The film is very, very roughly made, and in places surprisingly violent for a film ostensibly aimed at kids, not to mention the fact that its kiddie-friendly hero is presented as some kind of outraging alcoholic. I can honestly say that watching Son of Superbug hasn't left me wanting to watch any of the earlier entries in the series. The fact that the dubbing isn't exactly brilliant and that for its English language version, it seems to be edited with a hammer and chisel, resulting in abrupt jumps in the narrative and an overall lumpy feel, obviously doesn't help. Nonetheless, it still comes over as a poorly constructed piece with an overly complicated plot, poor dialogue and wildly variable performances from the multinational cast. Add to that the intensely irritating Pichu, and at one point it looks as if a mafia hoodlum played by Sal Borghese, who's no stranger to this kind of slapstick comedy, having appeared in many Bud Spencer and Terence Hill films. Anyway, it looks as if he's going to shoot the robot, and I was gleefully cheering him on. Anyway, with all this, with Pichu irritating the hell out of you and every other fault of the film, you end up with a truly mind-numbing experience like Son of Superbug.
The most difficult auto rally in the world, but this time it's something special. It's a Love Bug Rally.
I'm still a bit broken up over the last race, but a little body and fender work will get me back in shape. My toughest competitors are already here in Africa. There's Nick Hallmark, last year's winner, and James Butler, who's trying to establish a new world record with this strange-looking cushion fly vehicle.
Don't you understand, laddie? The only way I can win this rally is by driving as the crow flies. Right through the country, over mountains and through lakes. It's too rough for an ordinary car.
Oh, well, if I only had a propeller. Uh-oh, he isn't thinking of... He was. Should you ever decide to drive in the Africa Rally, the following accessories might help. Take one propeller, and if you plan to drive across water, add a couple of rubber swans. For driving through forests, some ping-pong paddles on the back wheels. And an absolute must for railroad tracks are locomotive wheels. Then you'll be all set for the Love Bug Rally.
After this, I'm joining a rodeo. Look out! Kindly take your trunk off the wheel. Stop pushing, Jumbo. Get your fat... Ah!
I've been cut in two before, but three pieces is too much. But a bug always keeps going, even if you're using it as a sled.
Pizza! If you step on my heels once more, you'll be sorry.
Please, not so loud. A lion, my dear, you.
You know something? I really miss those zebra crossings for pedestrians. It's enough to send you right up the tree. Nobody in Africa takes any notice of a little incident like this. Traffic moves right along. No traffic cops. And as far as tow trucks are concerned, I could tell quite a tale. Even the quickest race driver needs a rest stop every now and again, but that too can be a ticklish situation. And if a cobra bites you, there's only one thing to do.
Take off your pants.
What?
Drop your trousers.
I haven't ever seen a Scottish behind before.
All right, let's get it over with. Steady now. Very sensitive, that Scottish behind of yours.
And don't leave the car door open in the jungle. You never know who might want to hitch a ride.
There must be lions around here.
Lions! Oh, goodness.
Don't be afraid. You're safe here in the car.
Me? Afraid? Of lions? Leave me alone. I'm mad at you now. Why don't you keep your paws to yourself? You know, a manicure wouldn't hurt you.
Love Bug Rally. Fasten your seatbelts for laughs and adventure. Thrill to the splendor of the African jungle in the Love Bug Rally.
We'd love to see you.
I found myself watching something called Human Hibachi 2, which was apparently made in 2022, the other day. It was streaming on a Roku channel I had on in the background while I did something else, and for some reason I ended up watching it. It was, unfortunately, very much typical of many modern direct-to-streaming micro-budgeted horror movies. sadly lacking in just about every department, in my opinion at least. Yet it, and the film as a sequel to, seems to have a small but devoted cult following online. I strongly suspect that age plays a big part in how one perceives such things. I'm old enough that my seminal experiences of horror films involved watching Hammer movies on late night TV as a kid in the 70s. Thanks to BBC Two's horror double bill seasons that used to run during the summer on Saturday nights, not only was I able to run through most of Hammer's gothics, but also some of their psychological thrillers, most of the Amicus and Tygon back catalogues, older stuff from Universal and RKO, plus a whole load of independently produced stuff, including a lot of William Castle films and US-Philippines co-productions. It was quite an education. Then I discovered Italian horror films. This is the viewing experience which defined for me what horror films should be like, how they should look, how they should be structured, how they should feel. Even the lowest budgeted, most technically deficient of these films tended to have a certain sense of style reflected in their cinematography and production design. Most could create, even momentarily, a degree of suspense, eeriness, or just unease. All of which brings us back to Human Hibachi 2 and my negative reaction to the film. A backwoods cannibal movie shot in found footage format is probably the best encapsulation of the film, as it follows a family of cannibals inspired by the first film in the series, itself a found footage suburban cannibal film, presented as real footage in the sequel. My first problem with the film is that the whole found footage angle is not only has the format had its day, but it's much more difficult to pull off than it looks. For the modern breed of micro-budgeted filmmakers, it appears to offer a legitimate excuse to present poorly shot on a handheld camera footage that looks like a home movie offers a professional film. Poor cinematography, poorly framed shots, bad sound and lighting, amateurish acting, it can all be excused by the idea that it's meant to look like that. Doubtless for a generation of horror fans brought up on films shot in this style, this is what they think a horror film should look like. Explaining the following is the build-up. The problem with Human Hibachi 2 and many similar films is that it never really convinces as found footage. It simply doesn't look amateur enough. That's where the skill lies in pulling this style of film off, hitting the balance between that amateur filmmaker look while keeping it sufficiently professional to remain watchable, which is why they sometimes employ the framing device of presenting the found footage as part of a faux documentary put together by professional filmmakers. Something, let's not forget, actually goes all the way back to Deodato's Cannibal Holocaust, which is possibly the first film to use that format. But Human Hibachi 2 never manages to hit this middle ground. All looks slightly too glossy, too smoothly shot and edited to be amateur footage, but not smoothly enough that it looks truly professional. Instead, it just looks like a poorly lit, shot and acted no-budget movie without even the ghastly fascination that the average Andy Milligan movie, a 70s near-equivalent standard of filmmaking, brings. It is also fatally flawed by the omission of a proper framing story. While much of the movie is meant to be found footage, even to the extent of the unseen camera operator exchanging dialogue with their participants, there are other sequences where it's unclear who is meant to be filming the participants. A sort of shift from first to third person narration, to use a literary analogy. Disconcertingly, the style of shooting remains the same whether it's meant to be found footage or not. Aside from the look and problems with its narrative structure, the way in which the film executes its found footage format eliminates any opportunity for suspense, tension, or even any decent shock sequences. It can't even muster any decent gore, and the sight of dismembered bodies on screen quickly becomes repetitive, robbing such scenes of any shock value. Quite aside from the fact that such scenes have been done to death by horror movies since the 80s. It all comes over as old hat, a tired theme that isn't carried out here with any originality or verve. But then I'm judging Human Hibachi 2 on the basis of my own experience of horror films. I've seen the same subject matter carried out with greater style and energy in various Italian shockers from the 80s, for instance. But for those who haven't grown up with those experiences, to whom the sort of films I cut my teeth on probably seem like silent cinema, it might well seem original and in keeping with their idea of what constitutes a good horror film. To be fair, while I didn't like Human Hibachi 2, I wouldn't rate it as anywhere near the worst horror film I've ever seen. Sure, it was, in my opinion, dull, thanks to a complete lack of pace and narrative drive, not to mention the poor acting and lack of characterisation, but at least it was competent in the sense that boob mics, cables and other equipment didn't keep coming into shot. Moreover, even though everything was too brightly lit, that did mean that you could at least see what was going on. Also, while I feel that Human Hibachi 2 is all too typical of what I don't like about modern low-budget horror movies, it wasn't so bad that it made me want to give up on the whole genre. Micro-budget films can be made decently, and even the found footage format, when executed with a skill, can still be an effective means of storytelling.
Killer breeds a strain of giant bees that can kill a human being on command. The police don't believe him.
Fellow reckons he developed a strain of killer bees. Fantastic.
But these people know this terrifying buzzing sound is the last they will ever hear. The beautiful television star on a rural holiday, entangled in an incredible scheme, the rival beekeepers.
This bee is not only twice as big, but lethal.
The jealous, wealthy wife.
What are you doing? You must be mad! Get the whole place alive!
Leave me alone! Leave me alone!
Get away from me!
The innkeeper who fears for his daughter's life.
And I think you should stop going up to the Hargrove farm.
I'm sorry, Dad. I'm going.
The agent who is interested in 10% of the action. And what could possibly link the birds and the bees?
That could only be found inside.
Thousands of angry bees driven by a madman's secret formula. To swarm, to attack. To kill.
Perhaps I'm getting soft as I grow older, but recently, when a wasp's nest threatened to hold up my defoliation of my back garden, instead of destroying it and attempting to kill all its occupants, I simply relocated them to the end of the garden, where they won't get in my way. My attitude toward them was possibly coloured by my admiration for their sheer industriousness. They had, in very quick time, succeeded in building their nests in a hollow they'd excavated under a bag of garden waste I'd left on the border I was working on. Unfortunately, when I moved the bag, the nest was exposed and pulled out of position. Obviously, the wasps were startled and confused and started swarming around. Now, contrary to popular belief, wasps don't sting indiscriminately. They only do so when provoked. Waving your arms around and panicking is to them provocation, a perceived show of aggression. So I just moved very slowly, and they left me alone, even when I got close enough to get their nest onto a shovel and shift it down the garden. Unfortunately, it sustained some damage, but the last time I checked, they were busy carrying out repairs and seemed happy enough. Most importantly, they're now out of my way. Maybe it is an age thing, but I'm increasingly loath to kill even household pests unless there really is no other alternative. In the case of the wasps, They were also outside. If they'd been inside the house, I'd have had little choice but to get in the pest controller. But outside, it's a different matter. Out there, they keep far worse pests under control. Besides, I have plans for those wasps. I'm thinking that perhaps I can train them to do my bidding, like the eponymous Willard did with those rats in the 1971 film. Sure, I know they aren't as intelligent as rats, but the upside of that is while this might make them more difficult to train, it would doubtless also lessen the risk of them turning on me. Willard may have ended up being gnawed to death by his rats, but I have no intention of being stung to death by my wasps. Anyway, the plan is to train them to attack at the first whiff of a barbecue. As soon as that meat starts sizzling, I want them to fly to the source and swarm all over the perpetrators. With any luck, that will result in a quick cessation of any back garden barbecues around here, so I won't have to put up with their stench for the rest of the summer. Well, really, I mean, you know, it's like having an elephant farting over your garden fence. Is such a disgusting smell. Anyway, currently I'm wafting the scent from bits of burning meat at that nest whilst poking it with a stick, so as to get the wasps to associate that stench with an imminent threat, thereby encouraging them to strike back at the source. If that doesn't work, I'll just have to resort to trying mind control, guiding them via my mental powers. I know, it's a fantasy. But a man can dream, can't he?
How old are you, Mike?
I'm 12.
12. And how long have you been using heroin?
The problem. Drugs. The solution? Kill.
What do you think, Ahmed?
From the jungles of Pakistan to the ghettos of America, the call goes out. Kill. Prize-winning author Romain Gary exposes the pure, uncut truth about the heroin game in Kill.
A dead, rotten duck.
Starring Stephen Boyd, a man with one goal. Kill the source. Kill the contact. Kill the pusher. Kill the organization. Also starring Gene Seberg.
I didn't want a different life. I wanted a different man.
And James Mason.
Kill him. Machine gunned him on the way from the airport.
You can't kill them all, Brad.
I'm not looking for perfection.
I'm pretty sure that 1971's Kill, also known as Kill, 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 just in case you didn't get the message the first time. Anyway, I'm pretty sure this was the film which, when asked why he'd appeared in it, James Mason replied, because I didn't think that anyone in the English-speaking world would ever see it. Unfortunately for him, this Italian, Spanish, West German, French co-production was released in English and was widely reviled. Written and directed by novelist Romain Gary, the film is an absolute mess. Choppy editing makes an already confusing script virtually incomprehensible in places, while poor day-for-night shooting makes some sequences virtually unwatchable, all of which is combined with some poor performances from international stars and uncertain direction from Gary. Supposedly a globe-trotting international action thriller, produced by Alexander Sulkin, later to produce the Three Musketeers and Superman films, Kill seems to go out of its way to be as ludicrous as possible, with unlikely twist following unlikely twist and bizarre incident following bizarre incident as it builds to a truly insane conclusion. Yet it isn't entirely without merit and remains fascinating to watch, while all too frequently dismissed as being simply an example of bad filmmaking. A more careful viewing of the film would seem to suggest that it was meant to be as weird and off-kilter as it turned out to be. The problem with films which were as thoroughly trashed on their release and subsequently buried by their distributors as was Kill is that the very little remains on record as to the maker's original intent, because nobody wants to talk about it anymore. So we are instead left to engage in some informed speculation as to its genesis. What seems obvious from the film's scenario and structure is that it was intended as a parody of the whole James Bond-inspired spy movie genre. Not only does it feature a masculine, oversexed hero, who, the more violent acts and killings he performs, the more attractive he seems to become to the heroine, but it also has a plot which takes the various characters to multiple international locations, although here they all turn out to be grimy-looking and distinctly unglamorous. Other Bondian tropes include the strategy meeting held by the villains, where they lay out all their plans in detail for the audience's benefit. Except that, instead of the usual fabulous headquarters or glamorous villa or yacht or whatever these things usually take place at, this conference takes place with a porn shoot going on in the background. Moreover, rather than plotting to hold the world to nuclear ransom, rob Fort Knox or kidnap space capsules, this group of miscreants are simply interested in cornering the global narcotics and hardcore porn markets, and increasing the market for the former by hooking children on drugs just for good measure, because they're that evil. Taking a fashionably, for the early 70s, nihilistic view of the situation, the film takes the idea of Bond's license to kill to its logical extreme by having a rogue Interpol Narcotics Bureau agent taking matters into his own hands when the law enforcement and legal establishment proved adequate when it comes to convicting and punishing the drug barons and pornographers. But it isn't just him who takes this attitude. With James Mason's more senior Interpol investigator, upon being told by a local colleague that cohorts of leading drug trade figures are arriving in Pakistan, suggests they be machine gunned to death as they travel from the airport, with the killings blamed on local terrorists. Elsewhere, other Interpol operatives happily stand back and allow members of the gang to be mown down in cold blood by the rogue agent and his associates. The film's stance is all too obvious. Despite what James Bond type films might tell you, the business of international crime is anything but glamorous. It's instead sordid and unpleasant on both sides of the fence. All this is carried out against a background of poverty and deprivation. All of which could have made for a decent parody of the genre, interrogating all of its tropes and cliches. But for a parody to work, it has to be at least competently made as its subject, which is where Kill falls down badly. Rather than emulating the slickness of the Bond films, it instead comes over like a cheap knockoff of an OSS 117 movie with pretensions. The film is further complicated by the fact that it seems to have been used by writer-director Gary to publicly enact a version of his recent private life. His recently divorced wife, Jean Seberg, plays the female lead. Gary's script has her seemingly play out various of his grievances about their breakup. Early on, for instance, for no real reason, her character is seen as wearing an afro wig, and her screen husband, played by James Mason, remarks caustically about it perhaps reflecting her latest crusade, Black Rights, which takes her away from her marriage. And this appears to be a clear reference to one of Gary's complaints about Seberg with regards to the breakdown of their marriage. It's notable that in the film, Mason's character, particularly his hairstyle and facial hair, has more than a passing physical resemblance to Gary himself. The character is also, like Gary, a middle-aged man who finds himself cuckolded by a younger rival. In this case, the rogue agent, Brad Killian, played by Stephen Boyd. And in Roman Gary's case, in real life, it was Clint Eastwood. Actually, Gary reportedly challenged Eastwood to a duel over his affair with Seberg, but the actor declined. Watching the film, it is tempting to think of the Killian character as being an Eastwood surrogate, a young, virile, macho man of few words who reduces the concept of justice to gunning down or knifing to death anyone he deems bad. You can't help but feel the Mason character's disdainful view of Killian in his belated attempt to try and emulate his violent vigilanteism as he concedes defeat, reflected Gary's attitude toward Eastwood. As noted earlier, whatever the film's original ambitions, Kill, is ultimately undermined by poor execution with murky photography, confusing editing and leaden script. And to be absolutely fair, the version I saw looked as if it was a third or fourth generation duplicate of an already poor video transfer, which probably made it look even worse than it already was. Even the stars can't lift it, with all of them defeated by a script that gives them ludicrous dialogue and little to work with in the way of characterization. Indeed, the four main stars, James Mason, Stephen Boyd, Gene Seberg and Curd Jurgens, look utterly defeated by it all and give correspondingly weary performances. Boyd probably shows the most signs of life in his role as Killian, ridiculously attired in a leather jacket with no shirt and his shoulder holsters strapped across his bare chest, toting all manner of large firearms and knives and killing as if murder's going out of fashion. His apparently endless quest to dispense justice having become as much an addiction as any of the narcotics he opposes. But the film does have its good points. A unique and actually quite memorable musical score, a well-staged car chase partway through the film, and a climax that tumbles over into the surreal. Indeed, this final sequence is alone worth sitting through the whole film for. Have you ever seen the Monty Python parody of a slow-motion Sam Peckinpah shootout? You'll have some inkling of what it is like, but it goes far beyond that, with the bullet-riddled corpses of the gangsters leaping back up and jumping up and down as if on trampolines as a mortally wounded character experiences a series of bizarre dying visions. Not that any of this is enough to actually redeem Kill as a film. It's still an unholy mess, ludicrous and over the top, that fails to work on any level. It feels too clunky and inept to pass muster as a straight action thriller. Its tone is too uneven, its script too weak, and its direction and performances too unsure for it to work as parody. Well, its tone is too shrill and histrionic for it to work as a piece of anti-drugs propaganda, straight or parody. But it is quite fascinating, not to mention enjoyable, to watch as its cinematic inadequacies unfold on screen. It stands as a salutary reminder that even bringing together a wealth of on-screen and off-screen talent and backing them with a sizeable budget doesn't guarantee success.
Exciting and new, come aboard, we're expecting you, and love, life's sweetest reward.
You know, one of the many pleasures of watching dodgy streaming channels on Roku is that one keeps bumping into old TV shows that you never really watched back in the day, but seem fascinating when seen again today. Recently, I've been transfixed by The Love Boat, which originally ran in the 70s and 80s. I remember flicking past episodes of it when they turned up in the afternoon on ITV. But as nobody got shot on it, there was no nudity and there were no car chases, it never really appealed to the teenaged me. But seen again now, it's a fascinating time capsule of US network TV entertainment of the era. Schlocky, cheesy, cheaply produced on obvious sets yet imbued with a certain superficial glossiness. It exists in a world where nothing really bad ever happens, and even the worst of characters can be redeemed by the power of love. There are no hard edges, only soft focus. Which, of course, is precisely why it appealed to audiences and ran for so long. It reassured viewers that all was right with the world, that everything would turn out for the best, and that nobody would get hurt. Pure fantasy, of course, with no relationship to the real world, but for an hour or so every week, it allowed people to escape into a safe, cosy, and predictable world. That said, the main thing I've taken away from watching episodes is to wonder how Captain Steubing ever managed to run that liner when the only crew apart from him appeared to be the ship's doctor, the purser, a random bartender, and the cruise director. Oh, not to forget his grown-up daughter, who for some reason always seemed to be aboard doing I don't know what, I mean, seriously, they are the only crew members we ever see. There's never a sight of any other officers, any deck crew, any engineering crew, or even, unless they're required for plot purposes that week, any stewards. There are plenty of extras running around pretending to be non-speaking passengers, the only ones with lines being the guest star passengers of the week, but none apparently in uniform. On top of that, the captain never seems to be on the bridge. He's instead always strolling around the decks or in his office. Who's running the bloody ship? Mind you, I'm not sure it needs running as, judging by the fact that the decks never pitch or yaw, just stay dead level, the ship is never actually at sea. My other big takeaway is amazement at the fact that the ship used for the exterior shots, the Pacific Princess, has London as a home port on the stern and flies the red ensign, denoting that she's actually a British merchant vessel. I was convinced by the late 70s when they started shooting this series, most of the world's shipping fleets have been registered under dodgy flags of convenience. Liberia and Panama were pretty popular, for financial and legal reasons. Mainly the laws which apply on a ship at sea are those of the country it's registered to, including employment law, which naturally meant that in order to keep crew costs down, countries with weak employment laws were favoured, especially when combined with low taxes. So, if nothing else, we can be sure that the Love Boat's meagre crew were at least paid UK sea rates and had some legal protections against unfair dismissal.
And love won't hurt anymore. It's an open smile on a friendly shore.